Audi.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to episode 31 of the Big Travel Podcast, exploring life stories through travel. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand. I just wanted to thank you before we get on to today's guest, who you're absolutely going to love. She's wonderful. But thank you for listening to the podcast and for our growing audience. This week, we've reached the dizzy heights of number 2 in the iTunes chart in the UK in places and travel, number 1 in Luxembourg, number 7 in China, and charting high in other iTunes charts all around the world in the places and travel category, including Iceland, Kenya, New Zealand, Belgium, France, Sweden, Ireland. So thank you, everyone, including especially people from those countries. I can't tell you how rewarding it is. I'm working really hard to get you the best guests and we're really building up a momentum. So thank you so much again for joining us. It is much appreciated. Now, on to our guest for today. Whether reporting on the Brazil World Cup, the Canada Women's World Cup, or dodging tear gas in a football brawl in France, Kate Borsay takes everything in her stride. Her podcast, The Offside Rule, has been voted one of the best sports podcasts in the UK, and she's travelled extensively for both work and pleasure, Brazil, Canada, Bali, Kenya, Australia, all over Europe and much more. Please welcome one of the busiest reporters and newsreaders in the business, Kate Borsay.
I am a journalist and a broadcaster, and I've been doing it for actually a really long time now. When you get to the point in your life when you can say, you know, 15 years ago when I was at such and such a tournament or covering such and such a thing. So I do news and sport. I primarily started out as a sport broadcaster, but I do quite a bit of news now just to kind of broaden my horizons. I also run a female-fronted football podcast with a girl called Lindsay Hooper and Hayley McQueen, both fellow sports presenters. And we began that about 6 seasons ago, and like yourself, just started podcasting really. And it became and is quite successful for us, and we're quite a well-known brand within sport now. And that's brilliant for us because we can spread the word and also move more into kind of getting women into football and not, you know, making it normalizing women presenting sports coverage or, you know, covering a story.
There's been a big conversation, a debate going recently with the World Cup in Russia. And about women commentators.
Yeah.
And how has it been working as a female in a sports male dominated?
Yeah,
world?
I mean, I've only commentated a bit, so I've only done live commentary, which is quite different, I suppose, to going on the radio like Vicky Sparks, who you mentioned, and subjecting yourself to the ears of millions and millions of people. I think it's much easier now for a woman to work in the sports arena, but there is loads more to do, and I think it's that kind of silent sexism. It's where someone might put on an event or might put on a show, a TV show, or put a panel together, and without even realising, haven't put a woman in there, haven't thought about a female audience. It's really interesting. I was reading a tweet actually by Lord Sugar. He was advertising some sweet box, and the kind of tagline was, if your woman's fed up of you watching the World Cup, why not send her a box of sweets? And someone pointed out, well, this percent, that the viewership of the World Cup was 40% women. And they were like, well, actually, we're not all wanting sweet boxes, thank you. We are watching and we're loving it just as much as the men. So it's those bits of kind of silent or backhand sexism that I think still have to be addressed. And when you move into the real blokey roles, I suppose, which commentating would be something seen as primarily male, especially men, ex-pros speaking about a men's match, it's much more difficult for women, and I think people's eyes have been opened, and it's a conversation that's going to happen over a period of years. We're not anywhere near there yet, but I think people's awareness and people's want to do something about it's changed.
And the advertisers need to sort of sit up and listen, even if, you know, your average they bloke really might do. Not, because if 40% of people that are watching the World Cup are women,
yes.
that's a huge potential for advertising, revenue, sponsorship,
yeah.
everything.
Yeah, and actually, we were sponsored for a while by Continental Tires, who back women's football in a really big way. And you think, well, that's really unusual. Why would a tire brand, of all things, want to get into women's football? And of course, there's a big social responsibility box, and often brands choose what they want to be affiliated with, and they really go for it in that particular sector. But they said, look, you know, when you buy a car, actually a large amount of the decision makers are women. And so, of course, we like to get involved with women's football because there's a whole silent audience out there that people aren't paying attention to. And so, yeah, people like Dove, people like car makers need to look at what's happening in football. And of course, they need to increase sponsorship.
So have you been able to travel much through work?
Yeah, I've been really lucky, actually. I've covered 3 major tournaments. I think one of the big ones for us was going out to Brazil for the last World Cup. We're obviously in this current World Cup now. But we were assigned by BT Sport to kind of give the fan opinion. So the Offside Rule podcast, that was Lindsay and myself, headed out to Brazil, booked ourselves into the first 3 England games, and luckily tagged a holiday onto the end of it, because if we hadn't, we'd have been coming straight home. So we went to Brazil, started out in Sao Paulo, which was quite business-like, actually, as a city. We then went to Rio for a little bit. We went to Belo Horizonte to watch another England game. We didn't go to the first one, which was in Manaus, which was kind of Amazonian climate, because we just couldn't make it up there. And when England exited in the group stage, it was all very depressing. Luckily, we tagged, I think it was 10 days in the end, onto the trip so we could have a holiday afterwards in a place called Búzios, which is near the Rio coast, which was brilliant. I was pregnant with my second child at the time, Arthur, so I didn't go out so much, but Lindsay and a couple of other friends who were travelling with us went out every night, had an amazing time and absolutely loved it. And for that trip, my other half, Dan, came with me, and my daughter came, Molly, too. So she was probably one of the youngest England fans over there. I think she was about 3 or 4 at the time. Oh, we had a great time. And I think when you're a female journalist and you're traveling away and you're trying to juggle, obviously trying to juggle a pregnancy, being with my partner, also Molly as well, my daughter, luckily school allowed me to take her out, and we went to Brazil and had a big adventure. But you know, it sounds great, but we did the same thing in Canada. I was out for 4 weeks and they came out for the final 2 weeks.
What was the tournament in Canada?
That was the Women's World Cup in 2015 when England women won 3rd place. So they basically got the bronze medal, and they did unexpectedly well. And it kind of caught the crest of a wave for women's football, because it started to get big from that point. It is difficult because essentially, by then Arthur was born when we went to Canada for the Women's World Cup in 2015, and I essentially ignored him for most of those 2 weeks, having warned him and said, you know, look, I'm not going to get a lot of downtime. You know, we were working really extensively over that tournament, and I felt sorry for Lindsay as well, because she was dragged in sort of between him getting a bit humpty because I couldn't spend any time with them, and us being a bit overtired and the kids missing me. So in some ways it works when your kids travel with you, but I think you've got to plan it really well. And actually I would be hesitant to do it again where I'm leaving Dan on his own with 2 kids, because I effectively did leave him on his own in Canada for 2 weeks. He had a great time and he saw some brilliant things which I didn't see, but it's a really hard balance to strike.
I think it's very interesting that we're having this conversation. I'm not glad we're having this conversation, but men, do you think this is different if you're a men sports professional and you're traveling to report on events? Would they think the same?
I think it comes with the territory, and Dan coming along was much more so we could have an experience as a family. I was going anyway. He said, well, I'll jump on the back and I'll bring Molly too, or I'll bring Arthur too. And I think we thought of it as a bit of an adventure. Had I been going out there with an organisation, you know, with one of the major broadcasters, I'm not sure he would have come, because if I'm with the Offside Rule, then I can kind of plan my own time and sort of we're in charge of ourselves. But if you're working for a broadcaster, I mean, I know because I've seen posts from, you know, several other female journalists, Ali Bender's out there, Natalie Perks for the BBC, loads of journalists out there, obviously Eni Aluko's out there and Alex Scott as well, female footballers. And it's tough for them because they miss their kids like mad. And they're travelling, especially in Russia, all over the place, connecting flight to flight to flight, battling flies, heat, cold, a real variance of things, and they're doing it all without their kids. And so it is tough. Is it any tougher for women? I don't know. I suppose we're less used to being away, maybe, but I don't think it's necessarily tougher for women. I think we're probably able to say more easily, God, I miss my kids, and actually I'm having a really emotional day today, because there is always one or two days in a tournament where you have an emotional day where it's all rubbish, you miss your kids and you want to go home and you're just overtired and fed up. Can blokes do that as easily? Well, I'd like to think so, but maybe not.
I think it's maybe the person who travels more who's used to leaving their kids, and that might be the mum or the dad,
yeah.
The one who's like out to work full time every day, that might be both of you, and you're more used to leaving them, it might be sort of less of a wrench.
I think I found it difficult in Canada because Lindsay and I spent 2 weeks where we were totally absorbed in what we were doing, and I am one of those people, unfortunately. I just absorb myself, and I'm quite one dimensional. I don't ever sit back and kind of worry about stuff too much. I just go for it. And in Canada, when Molly and Arthur and Dan arrived, it then upset the balance a little bit, because we were both in the middle of the tournament. England were doing unexpectedly well. Things were flowing for us. We were getting some really good press. It was getting exciting. And then Dan turns up and the dynamic changes. Now, that's not his fault, of course. And he still had a great time. But I think in future, maybe it's better to just go and swallow up the whole month or 6 weeks. For the last Euros, Lindsay and I went out to Paris a couple of times. And we always try and go as fans. We don't go on media tickets.
Oh, that's interesting. So you're paying your own way.
Yeah, yeah. And now sometimes we're given tickets by players, and that's great. But again, we kind of sit as fans, really. And we went out to France a few times for that. And that was, of course, completely manageable, because we could just jump on the Eurostar and on one occasion get delayed for 11 and a half hours on a Eurostar, but managed to score about 500 quid's worth of Eurostar vouchers each. So we were completely happy with that. Happy to pass the 11 hours stuck
on
a train.
You were in a riot or something there.
Yes, yeah. So the first place we went to was Marseille. And yeah, we were stuck in a restaurant whilst there was a lot of trouble going on between England and Russian fans. And me being me, I was out there with my phone, and Lindsay was like, get back in the restaurant. And I'm like, no, I'm going to look, I'm going to film this. And she was like, you're mad. And I'm like, well, it's okay, I'll keep it safe for you. But, you know, I want to see what's going on. So literally, you know, I kind of snuck out for a little bit, but we were back in this restaurant just hearing bottles break and noises go off. And we could see tear gas, and it was being let off right by the restaurant, so that we would sit there with kind of plumes of billowing out near us through the windows. I wasn't ever, you know, afraid. I think Lindsay was perhaps a little bit more, and we were with a couple of other female journos then as well, who were a bit like, what on earth's going on here? But it was one of those situations where, yeah, you just have to sit tight. Fair enough, I went out and filmed a bit and tried to post that stuff onto Twitter. But yeah, it was just one of those situations where you felt let down and a bit sorry for what was going on, and obviously concerned for the England fans and for other people who might be, you know, innocent, sort of caught up amongst it.
It's such a shame when that happens, that minority of people, football fans, that misbehave from whatever country they might be. It just lets the whole thing down, doesn't it? It's happening
does.
Less and less, I like
yeah,
to think.
Yeah, and actually I should say, I did see a few England fans throw bottles, but the majority were singing and just enjoying themselves. And I think it took one person to throw a bottle, or to, I think someone lifted a chair up at one point, and it took that for the police to then set off with the tear gas. And so when you've got tear gas between you and the police can't see what you're doing. So then it got a little bit worse. And actually, I have to say, I don't think the French police helped the situation too much. On another occasion, there were large amounts of Russian fans, and that was over another area of Marseille port. And that was altogether more dicey. I didn't directly see that. We could hear lots of stuff going on across the port. But when that happened, which was the second incident really, or sort of happened alongside it, close to it, that was out of order.
So you mentioned getting tickets from some of the players. Do you know the players?
The England women players, we do, yeah. And we had a contact in the England men's squad too at that time. And so that kind of made it easy for us. I mean, we could have applied and done the whole media thing, which is fine. But I think for us, it's about offering something a bit different to what you get on the BBC or any other of the major broadcasters or papers. And it's about trying to live that experience as a fan, but with perhaps a broadcaster's eye or a broadcaster's voice or a broadcaster's way of reporting.
And that's really the great thing about podcasts, is that you can do that. You have your own editorial control. Mm. And I think that's probably why yours is so good, is that it does take, it's looking at something that's very, very popular, but taking that from a different angle, you know, not just as women.
Yeah, and I think I get, you know, the kind of ripe old age of nearly 40, I get fed up of kind of being shouted at by people on the TV, by reporters on the TV, or, you know, or even sung at or told, you know, reports that sound like poems. And whilst there is an appreciation there for that, you know, it's about a conversation, you know, for me, just like we're doing now, it's about the conversation, it's about where the conversation goes. It's about a bit like you mentioned to me earlier, it's a bit like having a list of questions and actually just not looking at them. And that's such a wonderful thing to be able to do. I mean, we love our podcast because we get to talk to really interesting people and the conversation can go anywhere. And it's as a broadcaster, when you're constantly pegged into a minute or 2.5 minute package, or you can only have this long to ask this question, and you must ask this question about the game, and you must ask this question, and by the time you've done those two, you've got nothing else to fit in that's kind of in any way different. When you're sort of constantly having to work within those restrictions professionally, it's so lovely to be able to do whatever you want.
And talking of doing what you want, you're a freelancer like I am, and I watch you, you know, with Facebook friends and everything, and I watch you and you're so busy and doing all these fabulous things. But one of the things I was very much intrigued by is you renovated a beautiful, beautiful looking house in France. Tell me
about
that.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. Well, we didn't, I shouldn't say renovate, because we didn't do the whole lot. We, with another family, I have one of my best friends, Corinne, is French. She has a partner who speaks French. They have a kid who speaks French. You know, French from France is a huge part of their life, and they live in London. I've always loved France and I love the language. It's my favourite language. Paris is one of my favourite places to go to. And we came up with the idea of buying a place in France together because it works out a little bit cheaper when you're booking holidays. You're not having to pay a premium price. You can just go and stay at your place. You can drive to where it is in southwest France as well. And we started the hunt for a French house. We nearly bought one in the Corrèze region, so kind of up near Brive. And we were close to signing, and then the lady pulled out. We don't think she liked English people. I don't know. But anyway, so that was heartbreaking. But we kind of got back on the horse, I suppose. And within a year, we'd found the place that we bought. And it's an old presbytery. So it's a priest's house. It's right next to a church that's on the River Lot. And it's gorgeous. It's got huge, you know, almost sort of half meter thick walls. It's, you know, it's a really lovely example of great old architecture. And of course, you know, it doesn't, you know, perhaps cost what it would here. And we kind of sort of tarted it up, I suppose. We employed some lovely Polish painters and just flew them there because we'd heard all these nightmare stories about engaging, you know, French professionals and working on a time scan. And of course, none of us had any time to supervise anything. So we sent these two Polish painters over there who had a great time, by the way, going out to all sorts of local full moon parties and all kinds of things that we've never happened upon since.
Nice gig, though, if you're a Polish builder living in London and someone says, go over to France. Yeah,
they just, and they were brilliant. And they spent nearly 3 weeks just doing up the house. We knocked down a few walls. We put in a pool as well, which took a bit of time. And there's still stuff that we can do there. But the aim was to have a little bit of an investment and be able to take cheap holidays. And maybe, you know, if it can pay for itself, so we rent it out through Airbnb and kind of through our friends. And by renting it out, if we can pay or make it pay for itself, basically, then that was going to be a winner for us. And it's beautiful, it's peaceful, it's quiet.
Describe the region. I mean, this is a dream for everyone.
Describe
the region.
So the Lot region is famous for duck and walnuts, of which I like neither. I'm a vegetarian and I can't eat nuts, so obviously it was a winner right from the very start for me.
Cheese and wine, maybe?
Cheese and wine, yeah, exactly. There are loads of vineyards. So to the back of the house, there is the Lot River, and Lot's a very medieval region. So the town of Cahors is about 40 minutes away. We're near a town called Puy-l'Évêque, which I think translates to something medieval, like castle on a hill or something. And it's a medieval town, and we're outside the town in a little hamlet, and there's a vineyards to the front and the Lot River to the back. And it's great for cycling, it's great for fishing, great for wine tasting. I mean, you can knock on any winemaker's door and ask the question, dégustation, which is tasting. My French is okay, but I'm trying to get better at it. Yeah, so it's a beautiful region. There's loads of old chateaus and castles and buildings that you can have a look around. And just mostly it's kind of a bit of an escape, and the kids are just in the pool all day. We buy loads of cheese, we buy job lots of wine, and we try and have our friends over as much as we can, and we just enjoy the countryside. The only thing that I would counter it with is it's quite hard work when you're over there, because you are, you know, fixing things that have gone wrong. You're sorting out why the oil's run out. Why is there no internet? Whenever the French have a storm, their internet goes. So you're constantly replacing routers because they've got weird electric systems. You know, ivy growing up the back of the house. So it is bliss and we're really, really lucky. But of course, it comes with its own responsibilities as well.
I interviewed the author, Kate Moss, and she talks about that region. She's written lots of books and around Carcassonne and not too far away from there. And what we discussed was, it's actually that part of rural France is actually a lot more vast and underpopulated than you expect, isn't
it? Yeah, it is. And actually, the town of Puy-l'Évêque near us is a working town, and that was really important to us as well. You know, there's no point sort of glitzing it up or sort of staying somewhere predominantly British. I think for us, you know, that there was nothing more authentic than sort of trying to be a little bit in rural France. And it also makes you learn the language. My French has got so much better since being over there often. And you can pick up a bargain too, I suppose. And there are a little pocket of English there. And I think there are little pockets of English all over France. Now, I don't think there's much of France where you don't see that. But it's not wall to wall. You don't walk into a restaurant and hear mostly British voices, which is really nice.
We're so lucky to just have a little drive away, or a boat away, and then a few hours drive after that we've got Italy, a few hours drive after that, you know, we've got Germany, Austria, Spain, Holland, Spain, Belgium, everything on our doorstep. And that's the beautiful thing about living here in the UK and being part of Europe, which I'm not even going to get into.
You'll have to do a Brexit special
when it happens. God, yeah, I will be doing a Brexit special, believe me. So where else have you been?
Lots of places. Where do I start? So I think, if I think about kind of memorable places, which I loved going to, my brother lived in Australia for a while, in Melbourne and then in Perth. And on both occasions that we went to go and visit him, we did a stopover. And the most memorable one was in Bali. We went to an island called Nusa Lembongan. I'll say that
again. That's very well said.
Yeah. We went to an island called Nusa Lembongan, and you can only reach it by boat. And there are no cars on the island either. And we stayed at a place called The Point, I think, which was right on the kind of cliff edge of the island. And Molly was about three. And we just had a mega adventure. We hired a motorbike. Molly did all the directions at the front of the bike, so strapped her in, and Dan and I jumped on the back. And we just pootled around this island for about 4 days and had an amazing time. And the snorkeling and surfing is really good there. We didn't do so much of that, but it's one of those places that's breathtaking and it's relatively unspoiled. And we just had a real blast. We always joke about the banana snake. So Molly was about three and we were walking along to the kind of the sort of local restaurant, and this yellow snake just inadvertently slithered across our path. And we were like, okay, did Molly see that? And she did. And I was just like, yes, it's just a banana snake. And having no idea, I mean, there is no such thing as a banana snake, I'm sure, but it looked like a banana. So that holiday became known for the amazing views and the banana snake, which then dominated most of our conversations afterwards, wondering if we were going to bump into the banana snake again.
That's the sort of thing that kids will remember for the rest of their lives. Yeah, which is why I think that if you can afford it, travel is so important when you've got kids, you know, showing them the world, whether that's just my family holidays, all we could afford was driving down to the south of France.
Yeah,
but
we did.
I say all we could afford. It was wonderful. You know?
We did loads of French camps when I was growing up, and we went to Italy a few times. But I do remember those standout journeys where I just read the whole way. You know, it would be whatever it was, like 14 hours. I would just read, have my head in a book the whole way, and probably me and my brother and sister, three of us, squashed into the back of a maxi car or whatever it was at the time that my parents were driving. Nothing high tech. Sure, we'd be fighting with each other, but we've got pictures of our old turquoise maxi pulled up at sort of various places in France with us sat on the bonnet eating an ice cream and stuff.
It's how memories are made, isn't it?
Yeah.
Those travel holidays. That's why I think it's so annoying with the whole, you know, strictness about school holidays. I can see why they do it for many reasons, because you want people to learn and everything. But when kids are really young, you know, it's so important to have that precious time with family.
It is. And you know, luckily school were okay about us pulling Molly out for the Brazil World Cup and the Canada World Cup the year after for the women. Had they not been able or not let her go, and she was young at the time, but had they said no, she wouldn't have had those experiences, you know. On the harbour in Vancouver. I mean, that's an awesome place to go. And actually, that would be one of my travel highlights. Even though I was working throughout it, Dan and the kids went whale watching, they went up in a helicopter, and they did loads of really cool stuff. I was obviously witness to all that from afar, but Vancouver definitely one of those places that's amazing to go to.
And how did you find Australia?
Yeah, I liked it. I mean, my brother was in Melbourne at first.
I love Melbourne.
Yeah,
really
and
nice place.
Melbourne's great, and we can all relate to Melbourne. And he lived right near the beach. He then moved to Perth, and I'd had kind of mixed views on Perth, but actually, it pleasantly surprised me. I think when we went, which was about 3 or 4 years ago now, the kind of coffee culture had sort of started to sort of open up there. Whereas I think it was quite traditional, and we'd been told it was very boring. There wasn't much to do, but actually, there was some great stuff to do. And we always do a wine tour, so in Melbourne, we went to the Yarra Valley.
I went there as well. It
was
incredible.
Yeah, and just being able to fit 6 wineries into an afternoon is brilliant, isn't it?
We went ballooning in the Yarra Valley, and then there was a wine tasting afterwards. But the night before, I found out I was pregnant. The night before a wine tasting.
Oh my
that's
gosh.
So
absolutely
bad
gutted.
Timing. Yeah.
Absolutely
I think
gutted.
I had a little sip of champagne. Like
yeah, exactly. And when we went to Perth, we did a wine tour too. Is it Yallon Drop? Yallon, I cannot remember, but it was the scenery around Perth is stunning. And you know, generally if you leave any of those big cities, and in fact to go out of Perth to go anywhere you need to fly, it's sort of one of those, you know, places which a lot like a lot of Australian cities is in the middle of nowhere. But if you do travel by car out of Perth, anything sort of between 2 and 4 hours, there the scenery is just stunning. I always remember we ended up at this place, and it was the kind of coast was there, and there was a big cliff drop, and we walked over the cliff and along some sand, and then just came across this lovely place for breakfast, just really happened upon it. And it's those experiences that I love, the kind of, you know, random wine tasting here, or the random place you stop for breakfast, or the wonderful person you bump into in a Parisian bar, and you know, and you chat all night. Paris is a really special place for me. I absolutely love it there, and I actually have a Paris list, because I'm quite often asked by people for recommendations for Paris, or if people are going, I'll often say, do you want some places to go to? And this was given to me by my friend Isabel, who lived in Paris for a period of time, as have a couple of my friends done now, actually. And I just, it's one of those places that I feel a real affinity to. You feel comfortable, and you feel like you could go a million times and it would still be interesting. And the fact you can walk across Paris is great. And I never get bored. And, you know, I have my little hit list. You can go for a hot chocolate in Angelique, which is a famous old hot chocolate and coffee house. Oh, there's just tons of places you can buy a bar of chocolate at this particular shop. That, I mean, Paris is
what else is
wonderful.
On your list? I'm interested in your list, because I've been hundreds of times as well. Have you got a list? You got the list, excellent.
Yeah.
Is it in that book? No,
it isn't actually. I've got a book full of random notes for you, which I can't even begin to understand. But I have it on my notes in my phone because I've emailed it. And I've got one of these for New York. Dan and I went to New York last year, which was great. But actually, I prefer Paris.
It's difficult to compare to the two. I love both. But
New York was a really big adventure, but it was really cold. And actually, I really didn't like the New York people. I just found them really rude. And I think, I don't know whether it's having a particularly sensitive day, but we were riding on bikes. In fact, one really good thing we did in New York was we went on the city bikes and cycled through Central Park, which was great. But the American New Yorkers were really rude.
They just get to the point straight away.
I just couldn't handle it, honestly. I'm so British.
We like to say many pleases and thank yous, don't we, the Brits?
Yeah, exactly. So,
mind you, they do in plenty of other parts of America. They sort of overdo that as well, don't they? But New York has this
particular way.
Yeah.
Angelina is the place to go to for hot chocolate on the Rue de Rivoli. Where else do we always go to? There's a place in the Marais called Le Loir dans la Terrière, and it's run by a couple of gay guys, and it's the best lunch spot ever. It's really lovely.
I love the Marais anyway. It's a really
We always, we tend to stay in the Marais or in the Latin Quarter if we can. There's a chocolatier called Michel Chaudon, which is on the Rue de la Université, and he does these chocolates called Parve, which look like paving stones, and they expire within 2 weeks of buying them. So you
have
got to
eat them
quick.
Like there and then.
But they are absolutely brilliant.
Oh my god, I so want some French chocolate right now.
And actually, with kids, we always go to Cité des Sciences, which is a little bit out of Paris, so it's in the kind of northeast of Paris, I think. And there's some great stuff to do there for kids. We often take our kids when we go to Paris.
I've never taken the kids to Paris, and I'd love to. So when I go, I will get your list.
And a boat trip. You have to do a boat trip.
The boat trip, the Bâton Mouche, is it? The Bâton Mouche?
The Bâton Mouche, yeah.
They're amazing. And it just gives you like a whole other, a bit like when you're in Amsterdam as well, to do a boat trip. It just gives you a whole other view of the city.
Yeah.
and you sit there and relax as the city goes by. And then afterwards, it's nice to sort of go, oh, you know, you can go back to that place if you saw something that you absolutely love.
And there's some amazing bistros. I think one of my favourite things about Paris is when you rock up to a restaurant and they've literally got starter main dessert. That's it.
But as a vegetarian, which I am as well.
Well,
actually, I'm a pescatarian, so not a real vegetarian.
Well, I am too, actually. Yeah. I just have to smile very sweetly and ask them what they can do. And I've never had a bad meal like that. There's a place called Le Pipo, which I think is in the Latin Quarter, and Le Papaye Paris too, which is around the corner. And they are both exceptional for that. And just, you know, happening upon random jazz bars and going to the museums. I sort of tend to avoid, when we went there last, I actually, for the kind of first time ever, did an open bus tour with the kids. And that was great. And actually, I came away thinking, my God, the Eiffel Tower is huge, which is such a stupid thing to say.
It's pretty tall, yeah.
But we sort of passed the Eiffel Tower so many times on this bus tour, it just felt like it got bigger and bigger. So we did a couple of really touristy things when we were there last time. But, you know, mostly I just like wandering and eating and drinking.
Yeah, and that's the beauty about Paris, is that it's a great walking city. Yeah. And there's a metro as well if you want to get around quicker, but you can walk everywhere, which is lovely. What else am I missing? Do you want to look at your list?
Let me consult my list. I think another travel highlight for me is Thailand. We went to Koh Samui for my friend's wedding, and she got married on a beach at sunset. And I know that sort of can be quite a kind of a classic thing to do, but it was just...
For good reason. It's
amazing. Yeah, it was really special. And we mixed our hotels up a bit. So we arrived... We actually did a stopover in Singapore, which was great, you know, a nice eye-opener. And actually was really surprised by how parts of Singapore are quite sort of European in style. They were little sort of pockets of it.
I mean, it was very colonial
city.
When you think of like raffles and everything like that.
I suppose so. We landed on Koh Samui. This is pre-kids, actually. It was probably why it's a standout memory, because you've not been dragged through anywhere. And we stayed at kind of a really small little resort, little sort of it was a kind of watering hole type place. Anyway, we stayed there. And then we went to this more upmarket hotel for the wedding. We got upgraded for the hotel, which is always a bonus. And we'd been, via a friend, upgraded for our flights. Now, we've never done this before. In fact, I used to have an upgrade trip, which I shall explain. Mm. We at that time happened to know someone who was working for the airline we were traveling with. And he upgraded us to business class. And it was just one of those experiences where we just had a great time. And it was just from start to finish, it was amazing, because everything about it was smooth and lovely. And we were, of course, pampered in business class, and it felt like a real treat. And I have on a couple of trips tried the upgrade thing before. And actually, if it doesn't work, you often get given a bottle of champagne or some sort of treat.
What is this upgrade thing?
So often people try and get an upgrade when they check in, right? Which is a bad idea, because everyone asks and it never really happens there. So you can try there, but if you're turned down, I think my top tip is, you know, don't worry about saving face. There's a new set of people at the gate. Ask again. So when you get to the gate, you ask again. And Dan and I have this thing where we're not married, okay? But we, at the gate, or if that doesn't work, on the plane, Dan will pull aside a female steward, or I will pull aside, actually often a female steward too, and say, it's our honeymoon. I really want to surprise my partner with something special. Is there any chance that you have a spare seat, or we could have an upgrade? And you try this at the departure gate, you know, sort of hush hush. And if you make it sound like it's this big secret, then the air stewardess or steward gets invested in this whole surprise. And so it sort of becomes a bit of a mission for them to make it special for you.
I love it.
Even though it's a complete lie, and it is cheeky. And I haven't done it. I haven't done it at all with kids, of course not. And the sort of least I've ever walked away with is a bottle of champagne. We've been upgraded to kind of Economy Plus before, when there were no seats left in business. A couple of times we've been upgraded to business too. And if you make a bit of a story and you get them to invest in it, they absolutely go for it.
It's no skin off their nose. It's not costing them anything.
No, and it's not. And they get the chance to
make someone's day.
Feel special.
That's such a good idea.
It has to be a long haul job, really.
Yes. So what else have I missed before I ask you my last question?
Let me consult my little notes. On one of our many trips, Dan and I went to Kenya, and that was a real eye-opener. We stayed in a place called Malindi, which in itself is really interesting, because I think it was occupied by Italians during one of the wars. So therefore, when you go there, pasta is a common course when you eat a meal. And that really surprised me. And again, little kind of, you know, pockets of colonial things going on there. And we thought it'd be great fun to get a boat and try some diving. Well, kind of a snorkeling, really, not deep sea diving. And we took this glass bottom boat out, and the guy turfed us out, and, you know, we had our little snorkels and stuff, and we were kind of pootering around, and it was all nice and everything else. And we got out, and I think I went to go and get changed out of my cosy, and Dan stood next to this sort of hut by the beach and proceeded to look at probably about 20 pictures of people or just sharks, and was like, what's all this about? And he saw our tour guide afterwards, and he said, what's this? And he said, well, you know, these are, you know, sharks that have been spotted here in the last 5 years. And Dan was like, you've just made us go diving. And he said, yeah, it is a really popular time for sharks these days. So Dan was like, oh my God, we were diving in basically shark infested waters. I think Dan said, so when was the last one you saw? And he said, well, actually, you know, it's a really popular time of year for sharks, but the last sighting was only a mile up the coast. So you're absolutely fine here.
We were like, because sharks don't travel a
sharks
mile,
don't
do they?
Swim, no. Do they? No. And so we were, after that, both thinking, oh my good God, after nearly encountering a shark. And I think it's just, as Brits, sharks are like the most scary thing ever. But to them, it was just like, yeah, you might see a shark. Try and step out of the way.
When you go to certain countries, they seem to have maybe less fear, or not such a sense of you might die doing this. You know,
yeah.
You seem to like take more risks in
some
countries.
Yeah, I know. It seems very scary to us, doesn't it? But yeah, no, apparently it was absolutely fine that we were swimming possibly with sharks.
Well, I'm going to ask you my last question now. And it's about music, because I always think that music goes hand in hand with travel. And this is like often elicits some unexpected and interesting responses from my guests. But if you had to choose one song that reminds you of a memorable or interesting or wonderful time of travel, what would that song be?
Oh, goodness. I'm the worst person to ask about songs because I have a rubbishy memory. So there's an artist called Jack Johnson who we started listening to kind of right when he was breaking through. And there's a song called Better Together. And when we went to Thailand about that time, that song was really big for us. And it kind of became our soundtrack to the trip. And it's just a lovely, I couldn't think of anything better to kind of, you know, whether you're, you know, ambling along in Koh Samui, whether you're going on a boat trip or whatever you're doing, sitting in a jacuzzi on your balcony or something. It's a really uplifting, real kind of holiday tune. And that song for me, Jack Johnson, Better Together, just sums up that whole lovely time.
That's lovely. Thank you. And that is really a lovely, happy, sunny song to be listening to wherever you are.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming
Thank
on the
you
podcast.
For having me.
Thank you so much, Kate. We wish you continued success with your work and travels and podcast and everything. Thank you so much for listening too. If you have time and are on iTunes, do pop over and write a review. See you next time on the Big Travel Podcast.